who produced the show. You can find me at chrishedges.substack.com.
Thank you, Chris.
Greetings, I'm Chuck Foster. Join me at 2 p.m. Sundays for Reggae Central, playing ska, rock steady, roots, dub, and dancehall. New releases, old favorites, and delightful obscurities right here on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A.
Coming up this week on L.A. Theater Works.
The new governess at Thornfield Hall gets the third degree from her employer.
Who are your parents?
I have none.
And your home?
I have no home.
Then who the deuce recommended you to come here?
Emily Burgle and Nick Torrance star in Jane Eyre by Charlotte Bronte, adapted by Christina Calvin, next time on L.A. Theater Works.
That's this Sunday evening from 10 p.m. until midnight. L.A. Theater Works right here on KPFK.
Hi, this is Lonnie Jordan, founding member of the band War, and I'm a big fan of KPFK, 90.7 FM Los Angeles.
Sunday morning, and welcome to Think Outside the Cage. I am your host for today's show, Jerry Silva. Mark Colfield, the iconic Mark Colfield, is on a short trip and will be back ready to go next week. I want to give a shout out to Philly Walls, who has graciously let me go ahead with this show, even though I had invited him on today, but he will be on. Philly Walls, listen for his show. Everything I engage in or have engaged in throughout a lifetime, my lifetime, has been informed by the injustice that abounds and surrounds. Likely, my strongest motivator has been how race has been used to control a population of people throughout the history of this country, but especially how it has been and is being used to vilify, punish, and terrorize African Americans. Most of my work for the past 25 years has dealt with the criminal legal system. Today's show will look at how a law challenges the blatant unfairness that has existed in the courts, tracing its origins to race. We'll look at it through cases of three men, victims of a system where justice and the law are on two separate paths. But isn't that true in all cases? I'm speaking of the Racial Justice Act, authored by Assemblyperson Ash Cholera, signed into law by Governor Newsom in 2020, and a few years later, Racial Justice for All was signed into law by the governor, and that made it retroactive. It challenges racial bias in cases where intent does not have to be proved, where racial injustice is very, very clear. So it's very important. So my guests are three. Three of them are black men. Two of them are innocent of the crimes they were convicted of. All three have been sentenced to die in prison, two by what is referred to as natural causes brought by the harsh nature of a lifetime of captivity. The other person has been condemned to die at the hands of the state and, in fact, came within hours of his murder before he was given a reprieve. The fact that Racial Justice Act had to be written says so much about this country. Knowing that it faced any opposition is equally telling. And why was the District Attorney's Organization's Association against the Racial Justice Act? We're going to begin with Kevin Cooper, whose case has gotten a lot but not enough attention. And there was an extensive piece that appeared on 48 Hours in 2018, then referred back to some years later. So I think I saw it in 2018 and a few years later. Welcome back to Think Outside the Cage, Kevin. As a very short aside, Kevin and I have become friends over the years, and his humanity and concern for others consistently stands out. Hey, Kevin, welcome.
Good morning, and thank you for having me. Greatly appreciate it.
Of course. You plan on making a racial justice claim. And knowing your case, even at the level that I do, which I feel like is a lot, I've read about it, but I know I'm nowhere close to knowing all of it. But it's really hard to assert guilt in your case with everything that I know, and the fact that a jury of your quote-unquote peers were quote-unquote convinced of your guilt is really hard to believe. But, you know, talk about how race was a factor in your conviction. And, in fact, how did the history of this country make yours and others' convictions almost inevitable?
Okay, first and foremost, I'd like to say I did not, and I repeat, I did not have a trial in front of a juror of my peers. This jury that I was in front of was a conservative Republican jury from Republican County, San Diego, which in the Racial Justice Act has been proven to be the county that sends the most black men to death row in this state. So it was inevitable that I, who was accused of, tried for, and convicted of murdering white people, would end up on death row coming out of San Diego County. Historically speaking, though, whenever a person of color is accused of a crime against white people or a white person, especially in a murder trial, race in this country has always made convictions inevitable. Some people of color who are innocent, in fact, have taken plea bargains, so they would not have to get more time if they got found guilty of a crime against a white person. So it's a game that these prosecutors play, and they understand how, historically speaking, race has been a factor in all parts of life within this country. So to take away one of their main weapons is something that they were against. This country as a whole was founded based upon racism in a large part. I mean, from the genocide of the indigenous people in this country to the enslavement of Africans from Africa in this country, to the exclusion of other people who were not allowed in this country based on race, like the Chinese and other people. And this country is all about race. And so in the criminal justice system, it is a foregone conclusion that when a white person has a crime committed against them and a black person is accused, historically speaking, and history is not a dead thing, it is always relevant in this country. This is why Trump and his administration is trying to erase history. They're trying to rewrite history so that people in this country won't have to deal with the fact that racism is a fixture. It's just American in this country as apple pie is. So I am not surprised that the Racial Justice Act has finally had to be dealt with and has been opposed by district attorneys.
Yeah, but I know, and I'm not surprised either, but it's so telling. It's so telling, and it's so disgusting to know that there is, blatant prejudice. Blatant prejudice. And, as you say, people of color, but specifically black defendants have far less of a chance of acquittal than do, white folks. It's just the reality.
Yes, it's a reality. It's a sad reality, but it is a reality that has finally been acknowledged, at least in this state, by the legislature in Sacramento, that, history and reality shows them, or at least shows some of them at first, that, hey, we got to do something about this, because we have just as much racism in this supposedly liberal state and certain counties within this state as there is down south in places like Mississippi and Alabama and Florida.
Oh, yeah.
Georgia. I mean, so therefore, if we're going to be supposed to be the beacon of the world and where we go, the country follows, well, we're going to have to acknowledge this stuff and start dealing with it in hopes that maybe other people in other states will do the same thing. That hasn't happened yet. And even in this state, certain judges are still fighting against admitting that there's racism in the criminal justice system, in the court system.
Amazing.
Prosecutions are fighting against it. And we had to go back to the legislature and get another amendment signed to it stating that the prosecutors have to turn over discovery in each case in which a person files a Racial Justice Act claim, because the judges were not ordering the district attorneys to turn over discovery, and the district attorneys ain't going to turn it over on their own, because somewhere in that discovery and in that information and those materials might be the evidence to prove that the racism did exist and does exist.
I just wanted to say about district attorneys, their one goal is prosecution. So in so many ways, they cover up, they hide, they overlook issues that, would exonerate the defendant. And that's what's so troubling, because it's supposed to be a fair and just system. I wonder if you would talk a little bit about how race factored into your case. I mean, some of the facts of your case, or would you rather not do that?
Well, my case is still being appealed, and I'm dealing with the Racial Justice Act, per se, to get in back in court. So, but some of the things that I can say are on public record.
Yeah.
And 48 Hours dealt with them, and the New York Times have dealt with them, and other, the Davis Vanguard newspaper has dealt with them. So the information's out there. And it's also on my website at freekevincooper.org. It's like this. There was a horrific murder that happened in 1983. One of the survivors, a little child, about 8 years old, told the police that the people who did it were three white men or three Mexicans who may be white. And I end up on death row. All the evidence that was there at the time supported what that little boy said, but that evidence up and disappeared. It was destroyed. Other evidence was planted. And typical things that the police and the prosecutors do from San Bernardino County, which is a sister county to San Diego County. They're both very conservative Republican counties. And the next thing you know, there was an all-points bulletin put out for three white men. Three white men were seen driving the victim's stolen car, but yet I'm on death row, right? And so racism, while the prosecution in my case did not call me a wolf or a dog or a Bengal tiger or a monkey or any other derogatory names in which they are known to call certain defendants.
You have 60 seconds remaining.
They took all the evidence that pointed to white people and reworked it and made it into to fit me.
Yeah.
And that's how I am now fighting this racial justice act.
Yeah.
So this is getting ready to cut off. Let me hang up and call back.
Okay. And as he...
All right, bye-bye.
By, as you know, as he talks about, they made it to fit him. Now, how is that possible? He was, at that time, weighed 155 pounds, I believe. There were four people in the home, maybe five, a man, his wife, and two or three kids. I'm not sure. They said, I believe, that there was maybe one weapon used, but the man was, who was murdered, weighed 162 pounds or something. Or, no, he was 6'2", and he did weigh quite a lot. So to think that one man of that weighing 155 pounds was able to overpower the whole group of people, no gun. It was a knife. I think there were a number of implements used. He's calling back right now. It's just, you know, it's just freaking scary.
You have a prepaid call from
Kevin,
an incarcerated individual at this California healthcare facility, Stockton, California. This call and your telephone number will be monitored and recorded. You have a prepaid call. You will not be charged for this call. To accept this call, say or dial 5. Thank you for using Global Tel Link.
Okay, Kevin, I want to say hi. Yeah. We do have someone, Spoon Jackson, also tried. Well, he was tried in San Bernardino County, but he will be calling in about 5 minutes. So I know
okay.
It's – yeah. Okay, go ahead. I won't say anything.
No, I just wanted to say this to conclude this Racial Justice Act conversation on my end. It wasn't just the legislature and people like me speaking out or other people from the grassroots movement speaking out. It was statistical evidence that could not be ignored, that Black people who were a certain, a small population in the state of California were a large population on death row. Something's wrong with that. That means, you know, and most of the people on death row who are Black were there because they were convicted, rightly or wrongly, of murdering white people. And so when you get into the statistics, and the statistics don't lie, the legislature said we got to do something about this if our criminal justice system in this state is going to be fair like they said it is when they put it on paper. So with that said, I will let you go. And
Kevin, Kevin, don't go yet because I haven't gotten his call. In fact, I think that the statistics show that Blacks are 14% of the state population, 40% of the prison population, and 42% of the population on death row. So, yeah, they don't lie. And that, yeah, and that tells, yeah. And, you know, the crazy fact that you're, what, 43 years now? I know 40 years on death row, maybe. With all the evidence that, you know, assert your innocence, that's been known, all of it, for all these years. You're still there. You are still there fighting your case. And it's going to take, hopefully, it'll take the Racial Justice Act, but that won't even prove your innocence. And that's like you have to go back again to prove your innocence.
Right.
So, yeah.
Exactly.
How do you stay above it all? How do you stay patient, in good humor? Because I know every time we talk, you laugh, given your circumstances, you're in pretty good shape.
Yes, I do that because, first and foremost, I am innocent, and my innocence keeps me going. But when I get down and out, and understand that while I am lonely in this prison, I am not alone in this fight for human rights, and that right. there are good people out there such as yourself and other people who I work with, such as you, who go out of your way to help people like me in situations like mine. And that also is inspirational and motivational, and it keeps me going. And the fact that I believe that no matter what these people have done, they still haven't been able to stop this. These legal attorneys from proving over and over again that I got railroaded and that I got framed and that I will prevail in the long run. They believe that, so I have to believe that. And my spirits are strong. My will is strong. And I understand that I come from a people, just as you do, who are not still here in this country because of America. We're here in spite of America and despite of what America has tried to do to us.
Yeah.
I'm part of that struggle. So I have to keep my eyes on the prize.
Yeah, and in fact, black folks have made America what it is today. I mean, we can't deny that.
Yes.
Even though black people are a smaller percentage of the population, if we look around us at the music, at trends, at art, at you know, culture, just everything, black people are very central to it. Yet, there's right? You know, yet racism lives and is very strong.
Yes.
And it's, you know, you,
yes.
I get that you thank us that are out here doing, in a certain sense, well, with my case, a minimal amount. But gee, you know, I can't imagine if I was in your place, I might say, be screaming. Why isn't everybody out there fighting for me? Look at what they did to me. I'm innocent and I'm 43 years in prison.
Right.
Don't you ever feel like that? Like, where is everybody?
No.
No, okay.
No, because there are people fighting for me. People who you don't know. The reason why I'm alive is because people fought for me.
Yeah.
You know, and the reason why I am still able to do what I do, people have fought for me and are fighting for me. I mean, the reason why I'm able to speak on your radio program, because you are fighting for me from where you are in your radio program and as a friend, as a comrade in struggle. And I understand that the role or the part that Africans and their descendants, which I am one of, have played in the building of this country. And this, and so do a lot of white people, especially conservatives.
This call and your telephone number will be monitored and recorded.
That's why they're trying to ban books. That's why they don't want nobody to read the 1619 Project that came out in the New York Times, because that lays it out crystal clear that in every institution built in this country, black people have been part of it, good or bad. From the medical experiments that were done on the bodies of black women without anesthesia and to other negative things, to the beautiful things that we've done. We've created damn near every piece of music in this country. You can't name a music in this country that we haven't been a part of, even country music. So we built the White House. Remember, Michelle Obama said she was sleeping in a house built by slaves. And she was talking about the White House. So there has, we have always been and will always will be part of this country's foundation. Yet, because we are, and because we are so strong, there are certain white people who want this country to be a democracy, but they also want it to be a white supremacist country, and you can't have both.
Right. I don't know that they want it to be a democracy. They talk about it like it is a democracy.
They talk about it.
Yeah,
right.
But whether or not they want it, and especially right now, I think they want it to be a dictatorship. But it is a dictatorship.
A white supremacist.
Oh, definitely. Right. And it's just blatant. That's what's so shocking, that it's blatant, and there are people, probably people listening, that support what this person in office does. And it is shocking. To some of us, it's absolutely shocking. My first daughter, who is a stepdaughter, but I've always called her my first daughter, she's a Trump supporter. So I can't even get on the subject with her because I get crazy if I think about it, you know? And she's black, by the way. So, yeah, it's just hard to believe. I don't – so we have a little while with you, Kevin, and if there's anybody listening in that would like – because I don't think my second guest is going to call in. So we have about maybe five more minutes. If there are any listeners that would like to call and ask a question of Kevin, you're welcome to do so. So we'll see what happens. Anyway, now I really appreciate this. I appreciate your patience and your ability to see beyond yourself, which is pretty amazing. It's always amazed me about you. And I think listeners should also know that the governor weighed in on your case and did not assert your innocence with everything that's out there and knowable. I don't know if you want to speak to that or not. No?
Well, basically, I was the first death row inmate in the state to survive being strapped down and executed by the state. And everybody who walked in that death chamber waiting room before me did not walk out on their own 2 feet. They were carried out in a body bag. Mm. And so then, after that, I was the first death row inmate to have 11 judges on a Ninth Circuit Court of Appeal say that the state of California may be about to execute an innocent man. Five judges actually said that, but another six wrote their own separate dissents, which agreed to that. And so then I said, well, we got to go to the governor to try to get me out, since he's supposed to be the fail-safe. And so we asked the governor not for an innocence investigation, we asked him for an innocence commission to be formed to look at my case. But instead of doing that, he took it upon himself to hire his friends at a certain law firm, and he made out this hell of an executive order what they were supposed to do, which they did not do. They did not do none of the things that he said they should do in this order. Then they rubber stamped it. Everything that they found led to my guilt, and then he rubber stamped it guilty.
Hey Kevin,
and that's how I got denied.
A listener is on the line. Maybe has a question or a comment. It's Harold from Santa Barbara. Go, Harold.
Yes, please.
We're having trouble getting Harold up.
I can't hear.
No, I can't either. Harold is out there, but not on the line somehow or other.
Okay.
And that's okay. And I certainly, once you file your case, want to have you back on the air. Go ahead. Finish your thought.
Okay. No, so basically, I'm just saying that after they rubber stamp this conviction and all that stuff, other people have came out and written articles about what they did and called it a sham investigation, that it was a sham innocence investigation. Specifically, Professor Laura Bazelon from the University of San Francisco Racial Justice Clinic and Charlie Nelson Keever, who was also there at the time, they co-wrote a op-ed and put it in San Francisco Chronicle newspaper stating that this was in fact a sham investigation. It was no more than repeating what the prosecution said. There was no investigation. There was nothing.
Yeah.
Because see, Governor Newsom has presidential ambitions. And what he does not want is the fact that he may have let a black man off death row out of prison, and then the Republicans used that against him if he runs for president, like what happened with
so
Dukakis
sad.
And that Willie Horton stuff back in the 80s.
Yeah.
So the man's a moral coward. He's a moral coward.
Oh, absolutely.
So that's what it is.
Yeah.
So, but in But in what they said is, I have to go through the racial justice act. So in one part, they denied me, saying that my conviction was good. But in another part, they said, I got to go through the race. I got to use the racial justice act to get justice. So that tells you what's going on right there. That they acknowledge that there's racism in my case.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Kevin, yeah. Kevin, yeah. I think we're going to have to wind down. I'm going to get, after a short break, I'm going to get to my next guest. But I so appreciate your being here and sharing what you shared. And listeners, freekevincooper.org. Read about him. You can look at the 48.
60 seconds remaining.
You can look at the 48.
Nice call. Oh, my God. Will be monitored and recorded.
Do they interrupt us enough? Yes. Free Kevin Cooper. Get to know Kevin Cooper. He's an artist. He's so many things. And, Kevin, I will talk to you soon. We're going to break, and we'll be back
with you.
Jeffrey Burks. Thank you. Welcome back to Think Outside the Cage with this condemnation of our criminal legal system. It's funny that people still call it a criminal justice system when it's so clear there's nothing just about it. So I'm hearing that my next guest is going to call right back. So I don't think they're on the line with us, are they, Irene? Yeah. Okay, so hopefully you're on the line with us. Are you there, Aisha? My next guest is the person who I will conclude the show with. He's been a friend for years now. I call him Hazim, but his name that he was, that the prison recognizes is Jeffrey Burks, and all his claims, et cetera, will be under the name of Jeffrey Burks. He's another case of factual innocence. And again, just like with Kevin, there's proof to back up his claim. But he's black, so it doesn't really matter, really, does it? I hope people realize that. It's not that black people have never been found innocent. They have. But it's also very common for black folks who are innocent to be found guilty, but even more of the case, to be more harshly punished. And there, like Kevin was saying, there are statistics to back all of this up. And if you wonder, if listeners, if you wonder, check the statistics, and you'll see that black folks are more likely to be given more time, more likely to be convicted than white folks. That's just the reality. Yes, it does also apply to Latinos, you know. It's to anyone that in this country is considered lesser than, even though we pretend that's not the case. They are lesser than. I'm hoping that we have our next guest on the line. Are you there, Hazim?
Yes, I am.
Oh, good. Well, welcome to Think Outside the Cage. And as I mentioned, you have been a longtime friend, and, you know, just been there for me, been there for others. 52 years inside, and no matter when I call him, he's always good. He has a smile in his voice. So like Kevin, I mean, I think of myself and how I would feel if I, you know, was there all that time, and especially if I'm innocent, I can't even imagine. So again, Jeff Birks, but I know him as Hazim, but Jeff Birks is probably the name that he was convicted under and a name that he's using in his claims, right?
This call and your telephone number will be monitored and recorded.
Right? Jeff?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. That is the name that I filed, that I was convicted under, and that is the name that I'm filing my racial justice writ under, Jeffrey Birks.
Jeffrey Birks. And there's even, I think it's a website, Free Jeff Now?
Set Jeff.
Go ahead, Aisha.
SetJeffFree.org, I think. I'll let you know. I'm working on it.
Okay. Probably setjefffree.org.
Yeah, okay. But let me explain that it's setjefffree.org. But it's, when you put it in, you have to put three F's. SetJefffree.org.
Oh, Jeffrey. SetJefffree.org?
Yeah.
Why did I think it was Jeff?
It is set Jeff, J-E-F.
J-E-F-F.
Three F's, yeah? J-E-F-F?
Three F's.
Okay.
Yeah, three F's. REE.org. Yes. That's my website.
Okay. All right, well, let's get into how race played a key role in your conviction, and which led you to file a claim under the Racial Justice Act, which is an act that never should have had to have been filed. That's a crazy sentence. We never should have had to, one never should have had to file a racial justice claim. Race shouldn't ever play a role in the degradation of people in this country, and I get so angry that I can't even talk. So talk a little bit about your case, because I know you've already filed your claim, so I think you're free to be as open about it as possible, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And I don't mind explaining it and relating it to people at all. So let me start off by saying that my conviction of first-degree murder was obtained by the use of racial bias, racial animus, and racial discrimination. There's no question about it, as we call it the justice system, but there's no justice at all when an individual of color, especially African-American or Latino, is faced with a charge in this country, especially here in California. The prosecutor uses racial bias, racial animus, and racial discretion, and racial discrimination to gain a conviction. Let me just explain briefly about my case. I heard you ask, Kevin, how did the jury find him guilty when there was so much evidence that proved his innocence? That's a refrain you will find maybe 98% of the time in this state. The people who have been wrongfully convicted and racial discrimination was a key factor in their conviction. How did the jury reject evidence of innocence and instead find the defendant guilty? I was charged with the murder of another individual in 1984 in Folsom Prison by a white correction officer who was in a gun tower on top of a six-story building. He accused me and my co-defendant of stabbing another incarcerated individual to death. The day after I was charged with that crime, another incarcerated individual confessed that it was him who stabbed the victim to death. 2 days later, the officer who accused me of committing the crime told my investigative employee that I was playing basketball when the incident occurred. I go to the committee, the 115 hearing, and they find me guilty of stabbing the individual to death. A week later, another incarcerated individual, after hearing that they had found me guilty, confessed to the murder. These two individuals who confessed were found to have blood and cuts on their hands, and at my trial, seven witnesses pointed them out as being an individual they saw stabbing the victim. So how did I get found guilty of a murder that two men confessed to? Blood and cuts were found on their hands, blood spatters were found in their face, recorded, and seven witnesses pointed them out and say that they were the individuals that stabbed the victim and I was playing basketball. How does a prosecutor convince the jury to disregard such evidence and instead find the defendant guilty?
Let me interrupt you for a minute. How does a prosecutor doesn't even have a case? There are other people who admitted to doing it. The person who pointed you out as the doer, the perp, whatever, said no. What do they have to go on? Absolutely nothing. How telling is that? So go ahead, Bill.
Okay. So the prosecutor will start off first with, they are skilled in using racial bias, discrimination, animus at these trials. So in order to get me and my co-defendant found guilty, he starts out by excluding blacks and Latinos from the jury. Hmm. That's the first step that they do. He uses his preparatory challenges of 11 blacks that are on my jury pool. He excluded seven of them. Of the eight Latinos in my jury pool, he excluded all eight. He filed a Wheeler motion halfway through the jury voir dire, citing prosecutorial misconduct because the prosecutor did not ask any of these individuals a question, any of the blacks or Latinos a question. He merely used his preemptory challenges to exclude them. And it didn't have to explain, although he claimed that body language, maybe life experiences, that they were not hard, was not strong on the death penalty, agreeing to the death penalty. That's why I excluded him. But the truth is, he didn't have to make up any excuses because the law says that he can exclude him. That's the law. He can exclude anybody from the jury pool, and he initially will start off with the blacks, and especially black women. He will exclude from the jury pool if they are the black defendant.
Is that still the law, Jeff? That still the law? That they can exclude?
Well, they can, and they may have to just state, because the judges hearing these cases, the Wheeler motion and the Batson motions, would give great deference to the prosecutor and the trial judge. So if the trial judge says, and here's the key element in that, when we file that motion against the prosecutor for misconduct, and the judge gave what he claimed was his review and denial, he showed his racial bias and racial animus towards us also by saying he denied our motion of prosecutorial misconduct because he himself had formerly been a prosecutor, and he would have did the same thing. In other words, he would have practiced racial bias, racial discrimination against us, and he'd been the prosecutor in this case. So he denied our motion for prosecutorial misconduct based on his own racial bias. The system here in California, there's a book, and I forget the name of it. I was just reading in the law library a couple of weeks ago. It's called Whitewashing the Jury Box, How California Perpetuates the Discriminatory Exclusion of Blacks and Latinos from the Jurors. Out of more than 2,700 cases in the last 18 years, where defendants have filed a legal motion for prosecutorial misconduct for excluding people of color from the jury pool, only two of those claims have been reversed. Because the system realizes that this is a weapon, you know, the exclusionary process or the prohibitory process that the prosecutors have, that's one of the key weapons that prosecutors have to gain convictions. And California appeals court and judges are not willing to take that weapon away from the prosecutor. So to level the playing field, they come up with the Racial Justice Act. They're saying, and this is what they're saying, oh, we know that the prosecutors are going to practice racial discrimination against people of color. We know that. Here you go. We got a way for you to overcome that 20, 30, 40 years later. So they're not going to grant legal motion. They're not going to grant Batson motion that defendants file because it takes away the power of the prosecutor to gain convictions. Again, in my case, clear example, 100% innocent, factually innocent. And yet, the prosecutor was allowed to investigate because, first of all, he put together a jury that he wanted. With the only three so-called blacks on the trial, no Hispanics, no Latinos, and then he convinces them using another racial tactic. And this is the second phase. All right, so we get the jury. In his opening statement, the prosecutor claims that he's going to prove that the victim was killed by a black prison gang. So here we go with the racial card, the racial prison gang card, right? The black prison gang card that the prosecutor is going to use. He tells the jury this. So he immediately starts calling, and he called in 19 black incarcerated individuals. And each of those black individuals that he put on witness stand, he asked them, were they members of a black prison gang? He asked them, was his victim a member of a black prison gang? He asked them, were the defendant members of a black prison gang? So he's telling the jury, and so when each one of those witnesses denied any knowledge of a black prison gang, he's telling the jury, look, these individuals are all part of a black prison gang. They're going to support one another. So I need you to help me convict them, even if they are innocent.
So,
hello, Jerry?
Yeah, I'm here. We're here.
Okay. So,
we're listening.
Okay, so I just wanted to make that point clear. So by putting...
You have 60 seconds remaining. This call and your telephone number will be monitored and recorded.
Okay, so you want me to call back?
Absolutely. We'll finish the hour with you.
Okay, so I'll be back. Hold on.
Okay. And as he's calling back, I am going to repeat the website and spell it out. And Ayesha, you can, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it is setjefffree.org. And in spelling it out, it's SETJEFFREE. That's Set Jeff Free. So just remembering the words, it making it easy to figure it out. SetJeffFree.org. Is that right, Ayesha? Oh, she's probably answering the phone. That's it. Definitely check it out. There's so much on his website that shows his innocence. And it's so crazy because these are two cases that are so clear where a person is innocent. And yet the person is, you know, has been convicted in one case. Well, in both cases, because Jeff was already in prison on another charge but was up for parole the following year when this event happened. I think it was in 1983. But altogether, he's been in prison 52 years. That's two lifetimes. That's unbelievable. But it's definitely a lifetime, you know, and it's frightening to know what they are capable of doing. But it's true. It's real. And I really hope that people that are listening can embrace this. Does that mean that whites are never unfairly convicted or that they are not over-prosecuted? Absolutely not. But what happens, and the reason that I strongly advocate for people inside, especially people that are serving death by incarceration or death by execution, is that the attitude towards them is that they will never change, even though the department calls itself the Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. But to deny that a person won't change, can't change, it's absolutely insane. Are we back on the air yet? Nope. Okay. Unfortunately, they're not back on the air. And my second guest, who I guess was unable to call or missed the call, is trying to call in, but I can't pick his call up because if I do, then Jeff might call back and then we're in bad shape in that case. But, you know, we do then have some time if Harold or anyone else wants to call with questions or comments or wondering why it is that I spend the majority of my time, and I do mean majority, my daughter wonders if, you know, I have a life outside of work. And I do, but I don't, because this stays with me. And how can it not? How do any of us live with that? Of course, isn't the only injustice. And, you know, listeners to Mark's show are always calling in with one form or another of injustice. I think we have Jeff back on the line. Are you there, Jeff?
Yes, I am.
Okay. All right. Well, we have about 7 minutes left, so go for it.
Okay. Convincing the jurors to convict a defendant, even though evidence 100% proves their innocence, is a tactic that the prosecutors are trained to utilize. They're skillful in doing it, and it's not only implicit or explicit, it's insidious, because they know what they can say and how they can twist, you know, the perception of the defendant from a racial point of view to convince the jurors that don't believe any evidence that the defendants are putting on. The physical evidence, you know, the two men who confessed in my client had blood and cuts on their hands, had blood splatters in their face. Mm. Actually, one of the weapons that was used in the crime was traced back to one of the men's cell who confessed. Okay. Seven witnesses.
This call and your telephone number will be monitored and recorded.
Pointed them out, identified them as defendants. The prosecutor, in his closing argument, without any shred of evidence connecting me and my co-defendant with any type of gang, even the judge even admitted this, there was no evidence presented at my trial to connect me with any black prison gang. The prosecutor, in his closing arguments, tells the jurors that after one of the men confessed as his own lawyer, he represented himself, he confessed in his closing arguments, detailed how and why he killed the victim. The prosecutor jumps up and screams at the jurors and tells them, don't believe it, don't believe it. He said, just like this black prison gang killed the victim, this black prison gang is trying to choke the life out of this
person. Oh, stop for a minute. Jeff, the prosecutor, what was said and what did the prosecutor jump up and say? Who said something that the prosecutor reacted to?
Well, one of the gentlemen who represented, he was my co-defendant.
Okay.
He would confess. And he was being tried based upon his confession by the prosecutor. Right? So after he confessed in front of the jurors, the prosecutor, in his final closing arguments, yells and screams at the jurors and tells them, "Don't believe it. Don't believe it. Don't believe him." He said, "The black prison gang that killed this victim is trying to choke the life out of this case. And just like they tried to choke the life out of that victim, they're trying to kill this case." So we filed a motion for prosecutorial misconduct. The judge tells the jurors that there's no evidence in this trial to connect myself and my co-defendant with any gang, and they should disregard those statements. But they didn't. They believe those statements 100% because of the prosecution's ability to use racial bias, racial discrimination, and racial animus towards the jurors, not towards me, towards the jurors, to convince the jurors, don't believe these men. Don't believe these black individuals. They're trying to corrupt our system. They are against you. Even though they showed evidence, Pooley Anderson, he said, do me a favor. He said, convict these two gentlemen, and we'll get the two men to confess later. Those are his actual words.
Oh, wow.
He said, do me a favor. Don't find these men guilty. They're bad men. We'll get them later. Convict these two men, and we'll get these two later. And here I am, 40-something years later, having to file a racial justice act to get my innocence, to prove my innocence. That evidence had already proved me that I was factually innocent.
So much has been brought to light by your investigator that proves your innocence. And the fact that they had to use a black gang and align you with that black gang to convict you, but then they are admitting that there are two other people were also guilty of the crime. Is that it? And
yes.
The prosecutor
yes.
is saying,
absolutely.
Were those two people also indicted?
They were indicted because of their confessions.
And
my co-defendant and I were indicted.
Okay.
Based upon the alleged eyewitness account. And the two men who confessed were indicted based upon their confession. And yet, the prosecutor, how do you explain that? He indicted them, but then he tells the jurors, don't believe them. Find these other two men guilty, and we'll get these two guys later.
That's so crazy. It's like a bloodthirst, you know? It's, I'm going to get you.
Yeah.
Period. With no reason. And like you said, racial animus. It's like, what motivates prosecutors like that? What is it, a notch in their whatever? What is it that would, you know, what do you think it is?
I think they line up these cases and decide how they're going to attack them and how they're going to convict people. Like you said, for a feather in his cap, you know, to show his constituents, to show his peers, yeah, look how I got this conviction despite all his evidence that proved these gentlemen innocent. Look how I convicted him. Look how I used the system. Look how I used racial discrimination, you know, racial bias to convince these jurors, you know, to convict these people.
Wow.
And the jurors walk away believing that they just saved society. They just saved society for this prosecutor by convicting two innocent men.
Mm-mm-mm. Yeah, this is the society we live in, and we all live in this. And I think everybody, you owe it to yourself. You owe it to your children and your grandchildren to do something, you know? And I don't know what that something is. I'm sorry?
Yeah, you have to stand up against this type. You have to stand up against this type of stuff. I heard when I called earlier, I heard you saying that something to the effect that you're not relevant, you know, that the people who put us here believe that we're throwaway people, that we don't merit any type of consideration, any type of justice. Therefore, they're allowed to do these type of things to us and get away with it. And I think the voices from outside the situation must step up and say something, must demand that the system changes, that the legislature did their part. I applaud them for putting in the Racial Justice Act, because without it, I wouldn't have any opportunity or effort to get out of prison. Even though, and let me say this briefly, even though after 40-something years, the only eyewitness who accused me of committing this crime, who later said I was playing basketball, my investigator, David Nairn, interviewed him a few years ago, and he now says that the two men who can